Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, May 11th. There's coronavirus in the White House, in case you haven't heard that yet. Vice President Pence's press secretary and President Trump's valet have both tested positive because of contact that people at the top had with Pence press secretary Kayden Miller, wife of Trump advisor Stephen Miller, in case you didn't know that. The head of the CDC and the head of the FDA and Dr. Anthony Fauci and the vice president himself are all now doing varying degrees of quarantine. You've seen on TV how they don't socially distance themselves at press briefings, right? And don't wear masks. Remember the president last month on his decision not to wear a mask on the very day the CDC advised that most Americans do so?
Well, I just don't want to wear one myself. It's a recommendation. They recommend it. I'm feeling good. I just don't want to be doing, I don't know, somehow sitting in the Oval Office behind that beautiful Resolute desk, the great Resolute desk. I think wearing a face mask as I greet presidents, prime ministers, dictators, kings, queens, I don't know, somehow I don't see it for myself.
I don't know. You hear that tone? I don't know. Somehow I don't see it for myself. So masks, I guess, are for the little people, he makes it sound like, and weak people, right? Not a manly man like him who meets with kings and dictators. He and his unused masks may have to quarantine too. We will see. Maybe then he'll have time to catch up on the Ahmaud Arbery case. President Trump, known for good people on both sides after Charlottesville, and white supremacy is not a rising threat after the Christchurch, New Zealand massacre. Remember that? Is taking a let's wait and see what happened before the tape approach so far. But his daughter, Ivanka, is willing to ask the following real question. Ivanka tweeted, "While the arrest of two suspects in the shooting of Ahmaud Arbery is a critical step toward justice, the question that needs to be asked is why it seemingly took months, the release of a video and corresponding public outrage, to catalyze action." Unquote. That from Ivanka Trump. Interesting that she stepped out like that from her father, which is rare. The mayor of Atlanta, Keisha Lance Bottoms, called the killing of Arbery in her state a lynching and said it came about in a Trump-era context.
With the rhetoric that we hear coming out of the White House in so many ways, I think that many who are prone to being racist are given permission to do it in an overt way that we otherwise would not see in 2020.
The mayor of Atlanta, Keisha Lance Bottoms, on CNN's State of the Union. With us now on Those Things and More, a member of Congress with experience as a local DA, Kathleen Rice, Democrat from Long Island, that's New York's 4th Congressional District, with very different kinds of towns in it that reflect the economic and racial diversity of the island these days. Mineola, Garden City, Hempstead, Freeport, Long Beach, such different places. She's on the Homeland Security and Veterans Affairs Committee and was the Nassau County DA before being elected to Congress. Congresswoman, always good to have you on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Can I ask you, as a former DA, first, your thoughts on the Arbery case, where the latest reporting is the former DA, before he recused himself because he knew the shooter, advised his office not to make arrests?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, I was as disturbed as everyone hearing the facts of this case. Just looking at the video, you see that this was a murder. I mean, it seems pretty clear to me. And to have a prosecutor on his way out for reasons, recusing himself because he had a personal connection that made him inappropriate to prosecute the case, to say the things that he did as he was walking, you know, out the door, so to speak, about how, he thought everything was above board. It was just inappropriate. But thankfully, you know, we've got someone, a real prosecutor who's going to put the case in front of the grand jury, and they're going to decide. But, I mean, just looking at the tape and looking at the facts, I mean, he was an unarmed man going for a run. It's just horrible. But these are, you know, the kind of cases that we see far too often. Just very disturbing.
For you as a member of Congress, what then becomes the federal role in this case?
Well, I guess it's yet to be seen. There was a no comment by the local U.S. attorney as to whether they were opening up an investigation. There are no, I believe there are no statewide hate crime laws.
That's correct.
So it would be up to the federal authorities to bring a case of that nature. And so that's yet to be seen. Most U.S. attorney's offices don't comment on ongoing investigations if they have them. But that is still a possibility. That may be where this case goes.
And that would be a classic role for the Federal Justice Department, right, to intervene on civil rights cases where local law enforcement is white-dominated and won't pursue justice when it puts white people in legal jeopardy for things they do to black people. Also, as you mentioned, Georgia is one of the very few states, I think it's just two or three, that don't have hate crimes laws, so federal charges on that would be the only ones possible. I saw Reverend Al Sharpton on TV calling on the Justice Department to commit the necessary resources to do a federal investigation. Do you have an opinion about what resources or actions they should bring to bear?
Well, I think that this is a classic case that should can and should be brought by federal authorities in the absence of a state, a viable state remedy. And so what, well, you know, I also, before I became DA, I was a federal prosecutor, so I know what, how these decisions are made in U.S. attorney's offices. And you put a team of investigators on the case and you see if you can make a federal case as well. But of course, they should work in conjunction with the local authorities so that they're not, you know, stepping on each other's toes. But certainly in a case like this, I mean, the racial, they're not even racial undertone. I mean, it's blatant that these men targeted him and ended up killing him. So I, again, I'm not the U.S. attorney, but I would be surprised if they're not at least looking, taking a preliminary look at this case.
On the White House setting a tone on coronavirus, the president is always a jumble of mixed messages. What do you think about how they're handling their own outbreak now?
I just think it's so ironic that the biggest hotspot in the country right now for coronavirus is the White House. I mean, you know, this is coming from, you know, my district, which is behind New York City, has the most COVID cases in the state of New York. But, you know, it's not surprising, Brian, when you look at the fact that for whenever you saw the briefings that they were doing for a time every day, no one was wearing gloves. No one was wearing masks. No, they were standing close to each other. They were not practicing social distancing. So it's not a surprise that that it would invade that space when you have people coming in and out of the White House all day. But I just, you know, look, when Mike Pence went to that factory and refused to wear a mask because he claimed he wanted to be able to look people in the eye, which was completely made no sense.
At the Mayo Clinic, no less.
Yeah, the Mayo Clinic, where he's seeing patients. That's right. I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Trump when he went and wore goggles instead of a mask. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Like, what is the point that they're trying to make? That they're bigger and stronger and better than the virus? No one is. We know that. It is indiscriminate, and the people it infects. But it's such a lost opportunity, whether it's the vice president or the president, to take a leadership role, be a real leader, and say, my ego is not so big that I can't wear a mask, so that, not because I'm afraid of anyone else, but I don't want to infect anyone in the event that I may have the virus as well. So it's just, but this is the kind of lackluster response that this administration has had. Look, coming from New York, it's been very difficult to get the president in this administration to take this, to approach this virus from a national standard. It's kind of been, it's kill or be killed. Each of you states do whatever you need to do to address the virus in your own states. And that's why it's become such a problem, because we don't have that unifying, you know, one voice saying this is how we're going to handle this.
Is there a culture war in Congress regarding masks? Another member, another Democrat from New York, said on the show recently that for those still in Washington, Democrats tend to wear masks, Republicans much less so. Is that your observation?
So when we were there 2 weeks ago, I did not see one Republican wearing a mask. Not one. And look, there is an outbreak happening. You know, the numbers in D.C., they're kind of lagging behind New York, obviously, but it is a major issue there. And I didn't see one of my Republican colleagues wearing a mask. And I just don't understand that mentality. I just don't. I mean, I have a 94-year-old aunt that I would never want to get sick. And I also know that there are people around me who have elderly people and other vulnerable people in their lives that I would not want to be responsible for getting sick. So, but it has become a messaging thing, you know, and that's unfortunate, because if you do nothing during this pandemic but listen to the health experts, you're wearing a mask, period.
Do you have any reason to believe that any of your Republican colleagues in Congress are wearing masks in private, just not for the cameras?
You know, I don't know that. I can't say that is a true statement, but I just don't understand why, you know, there were cameras all over Capitol Hill seeing all of us down there. I don't understand what the point would be if you're wearing it in private, but you don't wear it when there's a camera there or you're on the floor. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. When they had us voting, we went over in small groups and put our card in, and then they immediately took us right off the floor. They did not want people gathering. You weren't allowed to gather on the floor because the attending physician said that this is the only way that we can try to mitigate any kind of virus spread when you have 420 some odd people having to vote on a bill. So I don't know. You know, it doesn't make much sense to me. Why would you wear it in private and not, you know, in Washington, where the virus is still an issue, obviously?
And I don't have any theory that anybody is doing that. I was just curious if you had any reason to believe. One news analysis says the president is angry about the White House outbreak because it undermines his message that a lot of the country is ready to reopen. Do you think it does?
Oh, no, there's no question about it. I mean, if you can't keep the virus out of the White House, how are you going to open up, you know, put the light switch on, as it seems the president wants to do? He just wants to, you know, kind of say, okay, we turn the economy off, now we're going to turn it on full speed ahead. That's just not the way it's going to happen. Most states are taking the more reasonable approach of, it's more like a dimmer rather than a, you know, putting a light switch on or off, you know, opening some limited businesses, putting out requirements as to how you have to social distance people and they have to wear masks and maybe take temperatures and stuff like that. But yeah, when you have it right in the White House, which is the center of the messaging of this administration, saying there's no there, and a person who spends, I don't know, 10 hours a day with the vice president, his spokesperson, who happens to be married to Stephen Miller, who's one of the top aides to the president. I mean, how are they not? How are there not more numbers? I wouldn't be surprised if we hear more positive test results out of people who spend time in the White House. But yeah, that destroys the message that everything is fine, and we, you know, the virus is on the retreat. Clearly, is not in some places.
To follow up on what you just said, I'm just going to give some stats that people in and out of the New York area might find interesting, because we know the president, in his consistent delivering of mixed messages, will get up and say the rate of infection is going down. But let me read you some stats that seem to show it's going down in New York, but not elsewhere. New York, as you well know, is still the hardest hit, including your district. But there were 500 new hospitalizations reported statewide on Saturday, still really bad, but the lowest number of new hospitalizations since March 20th, when Governor Cuomo put the state on pause. But at the same time, Texas Saturday reported its third highest daily total of coronavirus cases. These stats are from ABC News. Texas reported 1,200 new cases on Saturday, and Texas's daily death toll of 50 on Saturday was the second highest in a day since April 30th. But as ABC reports, as Texas's stay-at-home orders are slowly lifting, residents are hitting the beaches in Galveston, says ABC. And they report that in Florida, there have been more than 2,500 new confirmed cases of COVID-19 since last Monday when that state began to reopen. There were more new cases in Florida on Saturday than there were in that state on April 30th. Now, that's not the same trajectory as in New York, where things are going down. And Governor Ron DeSantis allowed most counties in the state to reopen starting last week. I just want to, you know, I want to get to your district in particular in a minute, which definitely has issues. But do you have a take on national policy and the politics of it in light of those stats?
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, coming from New York, obviously my perspective is might be different from someone coming from Texas, but we knew how bad this virus was, you know, 2 months ago, obviously. And we were lucky enough to have a governor who took pretty aggressive action that he was somewhat criticized for in the beginning, but now everyone is saying, well, now we understand, because you had to flatten the curve and get the numbers down and fortify the hospitals and get PPEs and all of that kind of stuff. But at the time that that was going on, you know, there were comments coming from members of the administration saying that, oh, maybe they're doing too much, they're going a little too far. And you had other governors across the country saying, I'm not shutting down my state. And now you see numbers that are climbing up, like our numbers were in March, you know, February and March, and we are finally, hopefully, on a more permanent downward slope. But I'm not surprised, because, you know, to see that there are states like Texas with the numbers going up when they took a very different approach to, you know, how they were going to shut businesses down and what they were going to, you know, keeping people inside to stop community spread. Clearly, if you speak to the health experts, they're saying that even in New York, we have to watch the numbers very carefully, because as we begin to turn the economy back on, we are going to see numbers, you know, increase, hopefully not to the extent that they were two, three months ago. But it's going to be inevitable that the more you have people out and about, that the numbers are going to go up. But I this is where a national approach would have been helpful, to say, oh, it's only going to be a problem in New York and California, but not in the middle of the country, was not true. So that's where I wish that we had had an administration that believed the science, believed, you know, listened to doctors and healthcare experts, and maybe came up with a national strategy, so that now we are not, you know, as the president is saying, we've got to open up and jumpstart the economy. Well, certain states are feeling like they're ready to do that. New York is being very aggressive in terms of testing and building up an army of contact tracers, and we're going to isolate COVID positives once they're test positive. You know, we are putting that whole protocol in place, but a lot of states are months behind us.
What's happening with the next coronavirus relief bill? I know the New York delegation is pushing hard for aid to state and local governments, but Mitch McConnell wants liability protection for businesses that reopen. Do you see that as the basis for a deal?
I do. Well, you know, so the speaker has said that she wants to put a bill. I just literally, while I'm with you, Brian, just got a notice that we are not going to be called down to Washington to vote on anything. The earliest would be the 15th of May, which is Friday. But that would be if the Senate doesn't work out some kind of a deal. Now, let me tell you, Mitch McConnell is saying he's not going to do anything if there is not a way to limit liability for companies once we start to reopen the economy. And Chuck Schumer is saying, well, that's great, but I'm not doing anything unless there is aid to states and localities for the massive amounts of lost revenue that they have suffered as a result of the virus. Is that a deal that I would make? 100%, Brian. I would have no issue with that. I think we have to discuss the issue of liability, because, and it's not a, you know, a foreign concept. I mean, you know, if you put regulations in place and businesses follow them, and they create a as safe as possible workplace for their employees, they should be given some level of protection. I'm not talking about protecting bad actors who are not providing masks and stuff like that for their employees. But if you do everything by the book, I think that's something that we should consider, because I can tell you that, you know, New York State is on track to lose upwards of a minimum of $15 billion in revenue. How are you going to make that up when the economy isn't even back? So,
can you put a human face on that in your district? And it's interesting to hear you say there could be a deal on liability that protects companies that are taking reasonable precautions, because I've had other Democratic members on the show who've resisted that so far and said, no deal. McConnell and his pro-business cronies are just trying to let businesses off the hook to do whatever they want, no masks, no social distancing of customers, whatever. You're taking a different line.
Yeah, I am. I mean, look, I you know, the backbone of every community in my district are small businesses, and they need relief. And it's not enough. You know, we did the Paycheck Protection Program, otherwise known as PPP, and that's helping somewhat. But you are talking about lawsuits that would put, as if the virus didn't threaten enough businesses, you're talking about lawsuits that would put a lot of small businesses out of business for good. Now, I understand that that is not an approach that a lot of my Democratic colleagues take, but I am I'm a practical person, and I think that we have to have that discussion. It doesn't mean that it's a big giveaway to businesses and that we're going to let them, you know, have workers in unsafe conditions. Of course not. But we can come up with a rules and regulations that require businesses to put certain practices in place that protect their workplace and their workers. I think that is something that we can do. But look, you know, we're also going to need more money for the Paycheck Protection Program. We have to address the issue of unemployment insurance, because that's going to run out at the, you know, in July. And there are going to be a lot of people who don't have jobs to go back to. So what are we how are we going to help them? We have to ensure that we first and foremost figure out a way to increase the domestic manufacture of PPEs so that we are never in a position where New York and New Jersey are bidding against each other to get protective, personal protective equipment. I mean, that is just, that was outrageous, and that should never happen again. So there's a lot that we have to do. I think it would be hopeful. I'm glad to hear that we may be going back this week. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the Senate has to be a part of this too. So we have to come up with, between the Senate and the House, we have to come up with something that both Democrats and Republicans can support. And, you know, Brian, right now, if we can't do that, shame on us. People are hurting. People are hurting. I mean, every week I get on a call with small businesses in my district, every week since this started, to help walk them through the PPP and be a liaison between them and the financial institutions that are processing their loan requests. And these people are hurting. I mean, there is a lot of pain and loss out there. And then on top of that, you have a lot of people who have vulnerable people in their family, and they're worried about them getting the virus. I mean, there's just so much uncertainty out there right now that, you know, we need to get back to Washington and get to work.
Before you go, as a former prosecutor, do you have an opinion about the Justice Department dropping the Michael Flynn case?
Brian, do you have 10 hours that we can talk about?
Well, let me throw you their best argument, okay, because I can hear already where you're going to go. But their best argument, or a piece of it, is that there was a note that got released last month where an FBI official wrote about their upcoming interview with Flynn around the time of the inauguration. And the note said, what is our goal? Truth, admission, or to get him to lie so we can prosecute him or get him fired? What if an investigator in your office as a DA had written a note like that? Would it be so prejudicial as to cause a case to be dismissed?
That is a disturbing note. I would not try to justify that whatsoever. But it has to be taken in the larger context of the entire case. It's going to be interesting to see what Judge Sullivan does, because he does have the ability to accept the dismissal of the case without prejudice, which means that it can be brought again, or he can do it with prejudice, which means it can never be brought again. But the problem that my problem with this is not so, it is, first of all, let's not forget that Michael Flynn pled guilty twice. Okay. And now you're not talking, I've been there. I've seen people who have not had the benefit of a good lawyer, couldn't afford a good lawyer. Some people say, well, you know, they took a plea because they just wanted to get out. I get that. That was not Michael Flynn. He paid a really good lawyer a lot of money, and he still pled guilty twice. So it's important to keep that in mind. But it is just another example of the attorney general degrading the office of that office and taking the law into his own hands and doing the political bidding of the president. You know, for so long we heard President Trump say, where is my lawyer? I need a lawyer that's going to be loyal to me. No, that's not the job of the attorney general of the United States. And yet that's what he finally got with Bill Barr. And it's going to take, I think, years. And I'm not saying that you don't take bad actors within DOJ, the Department of Justice, and get rid of them. Absolutely. We've all had to make decisions like that. But that's not an excuse for turning the Department of Justice into a political tool in an election year for a president. It isn't. And hopefully the judge, we'll see what the judge does. But it's a disturbing trend that we've seen Barr, you know, whether it's Michael Flynn or Roger Stone, you know, the morale in the Department of Justice is terrible. People just feeling like the office is being used to do the political bidding of the president. And that's not the job of the attorney general.
Democratic Congresswoman Kathleen Rice from New York's 4th Congressional District, Nassau County, south of the Long Island Expressway, as she described it before. Congresswoman, thanks so much.
Brian, thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.